For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good morning. My recording means it's too late to back out, I guess. It's really great to see so many people here. And to be with so many Sangha members, I feel that I am embraced and sustained by this community. And I've had that feeling all week, and that is in part the basis for my decision to talk about the Jukai ceremony that we're going to have next week, in which four members of the Sangha, Kirsten, Mike, Chris, and Simone, will receive the 16 Bodhisattva precepts and will vow to observe the precepts in a ceremony that's called Zuke Chokudo in Japanese, which means the ceremony for householders achieving the way or attaining the way. That in participating in this ceremony, they are confirming and realizing, manifesting their Buddha minds. That the performance of this ceremony and the opening, awakening of Buddha minds is the practice realization of complete enlightenment. So it's a very moving ceremony. I always get choked up when I attend. It's a ceremony, it's a ritual. So there are physical aspects that go on, you know, there's a lot of bowing. The ordinands have their little bit of their hair snipped since they're not getting a head shave because they're not being ordained as they are joining the family of the Buddha. And so they receive a Dharma name and documentation of their Dharma name. They receive Buddha's robe. They have all sewn raksus, and those have been inscribed by their teachers. And they will receive those. And they receive documentation of our ancestors who have carried this practice and this realization through the ages to us. But the most important, really, the most important part of the ceremony is the receipt of the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. So those are the three refuges, the three pure precepts, the 10 grave precepts, the three refuges we're pretty familiar with. The refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Buddha is the perfect teacher, the example, but in a more profound way, Buddha is our Buddha mind, our original mind, our big mind, as Suzuki Roshi and Dogen used to call it. The mind that is with us always and that we actualize when we step back from or set aside our attachments, aversions, and delusions. And taking refuge in the Dharma, we take refuge in the teachings about reality, the teachings about the practice itself, but more profoundly, the reality we awaken to when we realize our Buddha mind. And finally, we take refuge in the Sangha, the perfect community that embraces and supports us. And perhaps more fundamentally, the compassionate, supportive, harmonious relations that we have as bodhisattvas with all people. Now, the whole, the phrase, the translation of refuge for the refuges in Buddha Dharma Sangha is different really from what the term is in primary languages. In Japanese, it's namukie butsu, namukie ho, namukie so. Kie can be translated as leap into or plunge into. But the character for kie is really two figures. One means return, and one means rely. And in commenting on that, Dogen says that taking refuge is like a small child. A small child leaping into its father's arms for security from fear. And to add a certain urgency to the idea of taking refuge that isn't quite there in English. So after having taken refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the ordinands will take vows to comply with the three purest precepts, because they're free from dualism, dualistic thinking and feelings, emotions, judgments, desires. They vow to embrace and sustain right conduct. Which is one translation of right conduct is intended to mean harmful misconduct. Deluded and deluded actions arising from a self-centered and selfish mind. And they vow to embrace and sustain all good. And the good is wholesome conduct from the awakened mind that conduct that flows from our original mind, our big mind, our Buddha mind. And then they vow to embrace and sustain all beings. So they vow to live so as to live in harmony with all beings and to live for their benefit, well-being, and liberation. So the last part of the ceremony is the vows to observe the 10 grave precepts. So a disciple of the Buddha does not kill. A disciple of the Buddha does not take what is not given. A disciple of the Buddha does not misuse sexuality. A disciple of the Buddha does not lie. A disciple of the Buddha does not intoxicate mind or body of self or others. A disciple of the Buddha does not speak of the faults of others. A disciple of the Buddha does not praise self at the expense of others. A disciple of the Buddha is not possessive of anything, or is not possessive of worldly or dharma assets, people who have a need for those. A disciple of the Buddha does not harbor ill will. And a disciple of the Buddha does not disparage the three treasures. And you can see why these are called the Bodhisattva precepts. You know, I won't kill people is pretty obvious. I won't take their stuff is pretty obvious. A disciple of the Buddha does not misuse sexuality, will not even become involved in sexual relations or relationships that could be harmful. A disciple of the Buddha does not lie. A disciple of the Buddha will not deceive anyone in order to cause harm or to withhold. Or to achieve some personal gain. A disciple of the Buddha does not intoxicate mind or body of self or others. Is really most profoundly in other versions of this is about not providing intoxicants to other beings to dull their minds or to cause addictive behaviors. Disciple of Buddha does not speak of faults of others, so there's that we will vow not to harm the reputations of others. We will not, and then that we will not praise self at expense of others, the same sort of thing. We will not diminish others. We will not be possessive of anything, that we will not be stingy with any assets, that we will share teachings and worldly belongings to people who need them. We will not harbor ill will, so we will not act out of anger or hatred, and we will not disparage the three treasures to speak poorly of the Buddha Dharma Sangha and discourage anyone from taking on this practice. So we've got a good list of things, fairly specific things that we won't do. But you will be interested to know that the teaching in Soto Zen and the prior teaching in Japanese Tendai Buddhism is that we don't really observe the precepts, the grave precepts. That the grave precepts are moral rules that are intended to lead us to awakening. That's what we have to do in order to be bodhisattvas. Rather, the bodhisattva precepts flow from, or the natural unfolding of living from our big mind. And that, so it's, these are different from the original precepts, the Pratimoksha precepts that monks and nuns take in other traditions, even today in Southeast Asia or China or Tibet, which are very specific rules about how a monk or nun is supposed to live, what they can and can't do, what they must do, how the sangha is administered in their twice monthly occasions when everybody comes together to recite the precepts and then confess to violations and then penalties are administered. That's not how these bodhisattva precepts work. No. The usual phrase, and for example, in the constitution of the Soto Shu, the Soto Buddhist Church in Japan, is that zazen and precepts are one suchness. They are the same, except for what's going on, what we're doing with our body when we live out the precepts in activity, and when we sit zazen, sitting without upright, without moving. But in both cases, we are stepping back from or setting aside thoughts, feelings, emotions, judgments, putting down this and that, good and bad, like and dislike, right and wrong, should, shouldn't, hope and dread, fight and flight. And when we do, as Dogen has said, as you know from the Fukan Zazengi, our original mind appears before us, and our original self appears before us, that when we are no longer caught up in self-centered, afflicted emotions of attachment or aversion, or thinking about ourselves as separate from the world, this separate, independent being, then this world, this flexible mind appears. And this world appears that is complete, vast, interrelated, interactive, interdependent, so that we are not separate from the world. Inside and outside, this physical world surrounding us, our thoughts, emotions, and so on, they form one reality in our life. And in that experience, which is underlying all of our experience all the time, when we are not distracted by our thinking and emotions, we are intimately connected with everything and with all beings. And from that sense of connection and intimacy, that being face to face with all other beings so that our eyebrows become entangled with the eyebrows of other people, we generate a warmth that results in our acting for the benefit and well-being and liberation of other beings. And that activity is activity that is in conformity with the precepts, the grave precepts. So it's something, Soto Zen and Tendai Zen emphasize this by saying, look, this isn't a bunch of rules. The 250 Pratimoksha precepts and the gosh knows how many additional precepts that women have to follow, that nuns have to follow. The Buddha, those precepts were announced by the Buddha. And if you read the Vinaya precept documentation, you see that each time there's a new rule, a new precept announced, the people came to the Buddha and say, well, hey, here's this problem, and this is a bad thing, and what are we going to do about that? And the Buddha would give a rule for it. But the Bodhisattva precepts are different. The Bodhisattva precepts are inherent in awakened mind and in the activity of awakened mind, so that no one created the Bodhisattva precepts. They are the precepts that the Buddhas have realized when they awakened, because they were there. And when they acted, they discover, as we discover, the Bodhisattva precepts. So we don't really work hard to comply with the Bodhisattva precepts. We don't say, well, I'm going to work very hard, I'm not gossiping today. Or look to the precepts exactly for guidance on what I'm supposed to do in a given situation. When we're thinking in that way, we have become caught up in dualistic thinking about there's me and these precepts, there's this behavior that I might do, and here's the ideal behavior that I'm supposed to engage in. And that kind of thinking is what actually distracts us from the experience of being right here as part of this world. This practice realization of complete enlightenment. And what prevents us from acting in a natural way that is for the benefit and welfare of all beings, and that is not just complying with rules. I'm not saying that seeing the Bodhisattva precepts as ethical rules is necessarily a bad thing. It's a good thing if that's what it takes to keep you from killing or robbing or misusing sexuality and so on. But as Katagiri Roshi said, look, we're not following ethical rules in order to become ethical people. We are practicing to be Buddhas. And so by extension, we care for others as a result of that practice and that realization of our awakened mind and realization of Buddhahood. So, I think I'm going to leave it there and open the floor for any comments or questions.
and please keep sitting on your cushions. Keep waking up to this original mind, this big self, becoming a part of your surroundings, becoming a part of reality that cuts through the entire world and your body and mind, and work for the benefit, welfare, and liberation of all beings. Thank you. You're done.
Yeah, thanks, Douglas. I found your talk very clear. And you used three words, inherent,
yep,
flow, non-dual. Mm-hmm. And I'm certain that Rev has said this. I think he took it from Dogen, but I can't place it in my mind right now. The statement that the precepts are the blood that flow through the veins of Buddha. Do you know, is that from Dogen or is that?
I don't know.
Anyway, some wise being made the statement. And, you know, I'm a total sucker for over-interpretation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I may be in a little danger here with that. But when you deconstruct the metaphor a little bit, you know, and think about, you know, sort of localize it and think about your own circulatory system, you know, and think of your inherent statement about inherency and non-dualism, you know, that's functioning way before this kind of confusion about, you know, being this being called Eric Schutt arrives, right? And we get really confused about that. And then we think that we, it confuses, we make up things, think we have to do something that may not be exactly correct. But I mean, I just want to emphasize part of what I was hearing in your talk, which is that, you know, those are functioning and sustaining, you know, even before we are explicitly aware of it. And I just think that's important to keep in mind, because there is this real tendency to think this project is about being good. And, you know, that seems to be something that happens along the way, but it can also be real dangerous to try and, you know, I am going to make myself into a good, ethical, Boy Scout kind of guy, you know? So anyway, thank you very much.
Sure. And the danger is also, it could be that by following the precepts and then we have our examination of conscience every night, and say, oh, I can't think of any of the precepts that I violated. I'm a pretty good bodhisattva. Hey.
Or the obverse.
But I think you're right that at least the teaching that we receive is that the precepts are with us. We will act out of this mind that is there at all times. It's our most fundamental mind that recognizes our interconnection and intimacy with all things, even if we haven't heard the Dharma. So this is a natural thing. It is so much a part of Zen practice that despite all of the formalities and some of the, you know, hard work that could be involved in Zen practice, it is something that is, there is, when we come to the awakening of Zazen, or when we live in accordance with that, we don't necessarily recognize what it is. When we do it, it's natural to us. On the other hand, I'm not saying that you toss out the precepts, the grave precepts, but I think you have to reconsider what function, what importance they might have for us. I mean, obviously, they're not a complete statement of all of the what we should avoid in order to avoid unethical behavior. So, okay, we're not supposed to kill someone, but we could beat them within a hair's breadth space of their actually dying. That would not be prohibited by the grave precept. Literally, Literally. And that's not what's going on, right? The grave precepts are there as sort of lane change alarms or flashing in your car, the safety equipment, the flashing blind spotlights, when that something is, there's danger here. You've gotten out of the lane. Wake up. Come back. You're acting from your small self that's caught up in thinking, self-centered, selfish thinking, emotion, likes and dislikes, judgments. So I think, you know, I think for me it's helpful. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, we treat words as being cheap, and so it's very easy for us to gossip or criticize other people or speak of, oh, how much better we would have done or how much better we did and that sort of thing. And it's helpful to have the precept to kind of go, oh, wait, you know, I'll just be quiet now and come back to right here and open up to that. So I'm not in any way saying, let's get rid of the precepts. Hold on.
With that being said,
yeah,
can you speak a little bit to the importance of the precepts being written down and then being vocalized for us as a group and for the ordinance in a ritual, in the sense that what does that then do for cultivating the empty field?
Yeah. I think that reciting the precepts out loud, memorizing the precepts, reciting the precepts regularly, and doing it together, for example, in, you know, the Bodhisattva precepts remembrance ceremonies that we have every month, and in the Zwike Tokuro ritual, you know, we plant a seed. We plant bright karma, good karma, to encourage us to remember the precepts and to remember to wake up. And, you know, that's true of so much of our liturgy and the forms that we practice. This is something, it's what we do is not some abstract intellectual exercise. It is something we do and that we embody, and we embody it together. And in the case of Bodhisattva precepts, it's good to and our ceremonies, it's good to remember that we live and act together, and we are acting, you know, we are embracing and sustaining each other. That is, you know, the most fundamental, and we are embraced and sustained by others, particularly in the Sangha, where people are focusing on that. So that's my two cents. Who was first?
Thank you for your talk. You know, when we think about the precepts, I hear people say, I'm taking the precepts, or I'm receiving the precepts.
Mm-hmm.
And if somehow they're innately part of us, what is it we're taking and what is it we're receiving?
You know, I think that that's just, it's a metaphor, right? The precepts are already with us, but we are vowing to comply, to live out what we are most fundamentally. So there's not a thing. We are recognizing a mode of being in the same way that in Zazen, when we take the backward step that shines the light within and we let go of all these mental operations, and our original mind, our original self appears suddenly. There's not some thing that we see or understand or experience. we are waking up to whatever the experience is and whatever the reality is right now. And the precepts are the embodiment of that awakened mind, the embodiment in activity of that awakening to this. It's not specific actions, it's responding in a compassionate and friendly and helpful way to whatever appears before it, so that we take care of other beings, so we take care of even the physical world around us. Follow-up question?
No.
Okay, thank you. Howard.
Thank you, Douglas. I really appreciate the word you used, unfolding, because it's over time with the precepts that I've been sitting with them that that's what it's felt like. It's more than unfolding, because I think for the first, like, 5 years, it's probably, well, I'm probably lying when I say only five, I was really rigid with them. I treated them as rules. I treated, like, without even quite realizing the extent to which I treated them like rules and prohibitions and things I had to do to be a good person. And, like, on reflection, I put them out there, right? I put Buddha nature out there somewhere for me to try to get to, things I have to do to get somewhere over there that's not here, which is also so much of my, like, a lot of my early years of practice, where I was like, oh, well, I'm sitting because I don't feel good and I'm not enlightened and I don't believe in this. And so it's over there somewhere. And after like decades of practice, I'll be fine. Maybe. I hope so. And the precepts are all, have almost been sort of this sort of like this unfolding process of like coming to just what shows up on the cushion, but also what shows up in daily life. Some of you know that I came from a different tradition before, and that there was a really strong emphasis on koan practice. And over time, these have really felt like koans to me, not so much in the sense of like go into an interview room and like have a question thrown at you and you have to like try to answer it in some kind of way, but like not unlike that too, in the sense of like I carry a precept with me that's like a question mark all the time. So it's not so much like don't kill, it's like what's killing? What's taking? What's receiving? What is gift, giver, gift? I don't actually know. And it helps me sort of settle into, like, what is the situation? How is it showing up to me? It's not that, you know, ethics or morality or whatever is out there somewhere. It's showing up right here. And it reminds me of one of my favorite koans, actual koans, not just the precept, but the what is the teaching of a lifetime, an appropriate statement. So I appreciate this, the reminder that the precepts are something that are sort of always there, like an undercurrent for us to return to, not something that we're like, all right, I will never kill, I will never take what is not given, or else I will be a bad person, and if I do them, I'm a good person. That is not quite like that. It's a lot more nuanced, there's a lot more subtlety. And it's a big question mark the entire time. It's not that these are settled things, it's that they keep coming up, whether we like them to or not. So just thank you for the reminder, for returning.
Thank you. Thank you. Chris.
Yeah, I'm wondering about, question is a kind of a why do we do this? So, you know, when I look at the grave precepts, it's sort of like, well, I haven't killed anybody today. I'm doing pretty good. Considering what I've done for a profession, you know, yeah, that's pretty good. But there's the other side, there's the positive side that, you know, that a bodhisattva preserves life, nurtures life, doesn't steal but gives. I guess my question is, why do we spend so much time on the grave side of it rather than the not so grave side of the precept? Is it just tradition?
Well, I think it's so that we step back from thinking generally, which getting caught up in all the conceptualization that we normally do, we lose sight of the reality of this more comprehensive life that we are a part of and that our thinking is part of. And so having rules of what we will do is also diluted. And so, you know, I think Dogen says that refraining is the most fundamental aspect of the Buddha way. So it's stepping out of, even out of these positive reminders to be kind and be compassionate and to take care of people and that sort of thing. I don't think it's not a matter of not doing that, but in a way it should be, it does flow from our sense of awakened connection with others. And we can use those kinds of reminders, sort of like a koan. When we think about, well, I should do this, or I can take care of someone, here are the ways I'll do that. Just being aware that that's fine, and that helps us to figure out how we're going to care for others, but also be aware that it's thinking, and we're not going to get caught up in, or immersed in, or dwell in, or abide in, or attach to, or grasp thinking about how to be a good Buddhist or how to take care of people. That the thinking is just, again, an unfolding, an unfurling, a flowing forth, an expression of the awakened mind. So, yeah, I mean, we can only live through language. But I think that the tradition has used those negative statements with that concern in mind, to avoid grasping, holding on to thinking. And I think, you know, inheriting precepts from, you know, sort of like the Pratimoksha, the 250 precepts that in the Vinaya. You know, the reason we take the 16 Bodhisattva precepts is that when the Tendai monk, very influential Tendai monk, Saicho, was working on performing ordinations, I gotta wrap it up. He said all these Pratimoksha precepts, those are that's Hinayana stuff, that's really negative, telling you not what not to do. So we're just going to have Bodhisattva precepts from the Brahmanet Sutra. And his precepts were the 16 Bodhisattva precepts plus another 48. And some of those were kind of like the Pratimoksha precepts. The one that really sticks with me is, well, you're not supposed to sleep on high beds. That's a pretty easy one to comply with. And I think Dogen was saying, yeah, that's not what this is about. This is about having this expansive connection with the world and responding from that. And Suzuki Roshi, you know, I urge you sometime to go to the archive of transcriptions of Suzuki Roshi's Dharma talks and search for precepts. There are a couple of places where Suzuki Roshi is very big on talking about formal practice and the sort of negative thou shalt not aspects of the 10 grave precepts, and the thou shalt, there's not a whole lot of thou shalt, but the Bodhisattva precepts that we embody as the unfurling of our Buddha mind are positives that we are going to embrace and sustain all the beings. we are going to embrace and sustain right conduct. So we will be caring for others and acting out of an unselfish, generous, friendly, caring way, embracing and sustaining all beings. So it's not explicit, but I think it's there. And I think that when, you know, in Japan, when they talk about the precepts, they talk about the positive aspect of something that comes naturally, flows naturally from awakening. Okay, I've got 3 more minutes. Serena.
Hi, thank you for your Dharma talk. It's really great to contemplate the precepts in this community. I've recently been reading a book about the precepts that's been really helpful. It's just interesting that that's what we're talking about today and that's what's coming up. And I really like that thing that you read that Dogen said about kind of like this, the precepts being like a parent or something, like a family culture that we belong to. That was like just like a, and also what Eric was saying about that, like this, you know, kind of being in our, like in our blood or in our bloodline. And also something that you were repeating is sort of like, it's something that we realize more than maybe like taking, you know, it's like the more of the realization, like this actually is like a path that is clearer and has less confusion and drama around it when having, you know, like, having some precepts as a guideline or as a mirror to our own behavior. And for me, it's not my behavior as much as my thoughts and seeing what I think and how they sometimes are like, you know, like thoughts that are like, you know, like angry, you know, angry thoughts that kind of like would like, they wouldn't kill somebody, but it's more, you know, things that are learned behavior, like, you're dead to me. Like, that's what my family does, like, when you stop talking to each other.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of us who don't speak for these difficult reasons, and it's, like, really hard, and just seeing the tendencies there to be like, oh, that's actually, that brings up the precept of not killing. Like, no, I'm actually not going to do that because somebody disappointed me. I'm not going to make them dead to me. In my mind, like, I don't do that anymore. And then, you know, and then, so I'll have those thoughts, like, oh, I prefer not to do that anymore because I choose for myself now. I'm not part of that family culture anymore. I choose not to. But then, you know, I'm in my kitchen and I'm like killing fruit flies anytime I can. And I'm like, okay, well, I just killed something, and, like, what is this thing about just, like, you know, like, oh, you're small, I'm going to kill you. Like, you know, you think about stuff deeply, and it is a question, like, do I have to be, like, so, like, yeah, like this knee-jerk reaction of, like, when, you know, like, I'll make these other choices, and then when it's time to kill, I just do it, you know? And it's just really interesting, you, like, I think about things a little bit differently, but it's, I don't catch myself before I kill them. I already killed it, you know, like I already killed it. Like I've been like clapping my hands all over my kitchen, you know, and I'm like, huh. Yeah. I can tell you there's like a delay there. So, and I don't know that like it's about the fruit flies, but it's like to contemplate it, like, oh, like, I didn't kill them. I just saved a life. They survived. So, maybe, I don't know if that's on topic anymore, but, yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you. So, as the speaker, I get to have the last word. So, you know, ethics are important, and ethical rules are important, but they're not the last word. I think that's what we try to say. And is in our aim at acting in a caring, supportive way as bodhisattvas, we are coming to caring for others, not thinking so much about obeying some rule. That's the different kind of emphasis. That not getting caught up on obeying some standard, some intellectual standard, but in being responsive to the needs and suffering of other beings. So I'm going to leave it there, and then we'll have, the four bodhisattva vows and announcements.
Do we have announcements? Do we have announcements?
We can forget about it.
Okay.
You'll just do the four vows.
The four vows are found on page 36, if you need it, in your chant book.
Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it.